You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore looking out my window at a bright, beautiful, sunny day in the Sacramento Valley.
Hey, wait a minute. I'm supposed to say that. And this is Lois Richter with a bright, beautiful, sunny Davis day.
I'm saying that because I moved where I record this back to my kitchen. I'm looking out at a hummingbird 5 feet away from me who is looking straight at me and seems to want to come in the window and join the conversation. No, it's going back to a marigold. Okay, let's just go ahead and do this the usual way. Bright, beautiful, sunny day. And I was very surprised to see this morning in, I don't know, one of my social media feed, local TV station telling us that we're going to hit 100 degrees finally this week or next week or something.
In Sacramento,
I thought that was odd. So I pulled up, as I always do before we do the show, the weather service to see what they're saying. We are recording this on August 6th to broadcast August 7, 2025. The temperature right now in the mid-morning is 72 degrees, going up to a high today of 95, which is warmer than it had been. And yesterday we got to 98. Prior to that, barely breaking 90 for day after day after day. Tonight's low is going to be 59, mostly clear. Thursday will be 93 degrees and sunny. This is in Davis. Thursday night will be 59. Friday, 98 degrees. Sacramento, 100. Friday night, 62 degrees. Saturday, 96 degrees. Sacramento, 100. Saturday night, 60 degrees. Sunday, 95 degrees. And cooling off as we get into the week. Sunday night, 60 degrees. Monday, 94. Monday night, 58. And Tuesday, slightly below average at 90 degrees. So we're getting considerably more influence off the ocean, pushing in with the marine influence. The Delta breeze is practically an all-day-long event for us these days. It has been all the way through July and into August. So we've generally been having a much milder summer than usual, as we've mentioned week after week after week. I went back and just looked at Davis versus Fair Oaks, which is slightly on the east side of Sacramento. Davis, according to the CIMIS weather stations, which I prefer to use, has not actually had a 100-degree day yet. 98, 99.5, close enough, and surrounding areas like Winters and Woodland did hit 100 twice. Sacramento has recorded 6 days at or above 100 degrees, but just barely. And so we have been cooler than usual, and we've been, of course, cooler as we get closer to the coast. And we have not yet broken 100 degrees officially in Davis, according to the weather site that I look at. We're going to be warm this week. 98 degrees is a few degrees above average for the time of year. I'm going to be dry. The humidity on a day like that drops down into the 20%, 25% range. If the north wind blows, it'll be even lower. This has many advantages for us here as gardeners. We've been seeing some mildew problems, for example, on cucurbits, cucumbers, squash, things like that. And that's because we actually hit the dew point a few times, which if you live in a place where it's more humid, you can go out almost every morning in the summertime and see dew on the leaves and the surfaces. That doesn't happen here. We rarely hit the dew point between about mid-May and mid-September. When we hit the dew point, one of the ways you know we have is we start to see powdery mildew on certain leaves of certain types of plants. In your ornamental bed, it's verbenas and even zinnias, old-fashioned zinnias, things like that will show some powdery mildew. In your vegetable garden, it's particularly cucumbers, squash, those types of, you know, members of Cucurbitaceae. Well, in the years past, you probably would have purchased a fungicide and sprayed those plants to prevent any further damage from the mildew. Those fungicides are gone. The fungicides that would work on mildew are preventative. So once you bring in a leaf and show it to me and I say, that's mildew, what can I do? Well, what you should have done if you were going to spray something was start earlier and spray routinely as a preventative. I can tell you something as a longtime retailer, people don't do that anymore. They don't just go out and casually spray their gardens with fungicides and insecticides. It's much, much less common than it used to be. So then the next question is, should I be worried about it? Is there anything I can do? And the answer is, you probably don't need to worry about it. Because if we get into anything close to normal weather, like we're getting to this week, with lower humidity, it will probably stop spreading. If you want to do something about it, it's important to know that powdery mildew is on the leaf, not in the leaf. So it's growing on the surface. It's not rooting into the leaf or actually penetrating it. So you can actually, unlike many diseases, wash it off. So as we tell you with aphids, white flies, spider mites, as with those with powdery mildew, just vigorously rinsing a plant that has it on the surface, preferably early in the day, but that's not as crucial in our climate as it might be elsewhere. You can actually wash off the mildew, clean up the plant, make it nice and healthy. The beneficial insects nearby will be happy if you do that anyway. It's a good thing to do in your garden every now and then and manage the mildew that way. And the good news is a vigorously growing cucumber, pumpkin, squash will grow and yield just fine in spite of powdery mildew on the leaves. So we are seeing some of that as a consequence of the weirdly cooler weather we had been having. Usually we see mildew here in our gardens late in the season. It's one of those end of summer things. It's just part of the decline of your vegetable garden in late September into October. And it goes for some of your flowers as well. I mentioned verbena as a good example, and old-fashioned zinnias and some other flowers that just start getting mildew on the leaves as the season winds down. Well, for most people, that's just part of the end of the season. So it's not that big a deal. You cut them back, you take them out, problem solved. You've harvested all your cucumbers by then. It's a little unusual for us here in the Sacramento Valley to see much in the way of mildew at this time of year. It's normally not a problem July, August, early September, because we are generally very warm and, more importantly, very low humidity.
So I want to educate listeners a little bit about some of the place names that you mention frequently. We say the Sacramento Valley, yes, and then we say Sacramento. Now, Sacramento is a city.
Yes, very good.
Sacramento Valley is a huge, long region. The upper third of California has mountains ringing the outside, and then there's this giant valley where the Sacramento River goes, yep, and that's called the Sacramento Valley. So when we say that, we don't mean we're going to the city of Sacramento.
Correct. Sacramento Valley Sacramento Valley is the northern part of the Great Central Valley, and the southern part of the Great Central Valley is the San Joaquin Valley, and the two together are several hundred miles north to south. And we have many climate characteristics in common with the other cities in the valley, ranging from Button Willow and Fresno and Bakersfield down in the San Joaquin Valley up to Red Bluff and Redding, hot, dry. But what we do have here that's different is strong coastal influence, more so than all those other cities.
So when he talks about Winters, Woodland, Sacramento, they're all surrounding us.
And they're all different sunset zones.
That's right.
They're all the same USDA zone, but they're all different sunset zones. And the primary difference of the sunset zones is the Delta influence in our part of California. Fairfield is the gate. Fairfield is the gate to the Bay Area when you're going west, the gate to the valley when you're coming in east. And something someone told me years and years ago, if you want to know what the temperatures are going to be, whether we're going to cool off, whether the Delta breeze is going to get to us, look at the temperature in Fairfield, because it is right on the edge between strong bay influence and interior influence. And whatever the temperature is in Fairfield at, say, 7 p.m., and the wind speed there tells you what it's going to be in Davis in about 30 minutes or an hour. And if you see it's 10 degrees cooler in Fairfield at 7 p.m., you know the Delta breeze is coming in. Sometimes we get a big high-pressure ridge parking over us, a heat wave that lasts for 3 or 4 days, and it's hotter in Fairfield at 7 p.m. than in Davis. That's going to be an uncomfortable evening. Check out the other cool programming here. We mentioned Davisville a week or two ago because Bill Buchanan's program is phenomenal. Well, here, Bill and I are overlapping on a particular topic of enthusiasm that we both have. He is talking about Vince Guaraldi on August 4th. You can go check out this program anytime because it's a public affairs program, so it's there forever. Vince Guaraldi did the music for the Peanuts TV series. Mm-hmm. And local author Derek Bang, who was also my editor at the Davis Enterprise for over a decade, has written books on Peanuts, Charles Schulz, and the music of Vince Guaraldi, that wonderful West Coast jazz music that is the soundtrack to all of the Peanuts TV shows. Well, Bill interviewed Derek, an update of his book. Derek has a new updated version of his biography, Events Giraldi, out. And Davisville, August 4, 2025, Derek makes the comment, I want Giraldi to become one of our Tchaikovskys. I want you all, he says, to appreciate Vince Giraldi. And it's interesting, when I play Giraldi on my jazz show, Jazz After Dark, I almost always get comments about it. People love the music of Vince Giraldi. For a lot of us of a certain age who grew up with the Peanuts TV shows, it's the background music, and everybody loves that particular type of West Coast cool jazz. Well, Davisville, August 4, 2025, Bill Buchanan interviews Derek Bang, always a lively conversation, and you can check it out at kdrt.org.
So I want to look at the thing that Don sent me. He said, this week's Watering Discussions. So he has a commercial place, Redwood Barn Nursery, and people come in and ask him questions and deal with, you know, problems and all that stuff. So here we go. Oh, Don, this is so depressing.
Well, so okay, let's make it positive.
Don was able to help them.
Yes, we hope.
So someone came in and said their crepe myrtle isn't doing well. He asked, how are you watering? It's on a drip. How often do you run it? I don't know. Maybe 3 weeks, three times a week, I think. How long do you run it? I don't know. Maybe 20 minutes.
Okay, so the crepe myrtle is getting 1 hour total with a drip system per week. Good example. Move on to the next one. Go ahead.
Okay, so that's not enough water. Just in case you're wondering where we're going with this, that's not enough water. And then this person is buying a plumbago plant. It'll be on my drip system daily.
Oh, great. Okay. Shouldn't need to water it daily. Every couple of days should be fine. How long does your drip system run?
4 minutes.
Okay.
That's like taking a teaspoon.
One gallon of water is 128 ounces. A typical emitter, Netafim brand, puts out 0.4 gallons per hour. So that puts out 52 ounces in 1 hour. So in 4 minutes, it produces 3.47 ounces of water. Right.
That's half a cup.
A coffee cup holds 8 ounces. So half a coffee cup of water every day is not enough water for pretty much anything. Okay, next.
All right, back to things that have walked into Don's store.
Usually the owner, but yes.
Yeah, the people walk in and then they say things like this. I love this one. I'm looking for something my chickens might eat, but not destroy. And a fast grower?
So I'm stumped occasionally by questions from my customers, and this one definitely stumped me. I came up with two after the fact, what I would try. Here's the key problem. It really depends on how big an area you have devoted to your chickens. Because when we've had birds, if they're free range-ish, you know, wandering all over the backyard, they aren't going to destroy a plant. They'll eat this one, they'll eat that. Maybe they'll do a fair bit of damage, then they'll move on to the next thing. But if you have them more or less penned into an area, it's going to be bare dirt in there pretty quickly. They'll eat pretty much everything. So it depends on what your ratio, your floor area ratio is for your chickens or your ducks. They're even worse. So that's the first thing. There's nothing that's going to survive in a chicken coop with 10 chickens in a 10 by 10 area. No, that's just not going to work. But I immediately thought of two things. One is buckwheat. Buckwheat is a summer cover crop, not the shrub buckwheat, not Eriogonum, but the summer cover crop buckwheat, which is planted here May through midsummer and grows very rapidly. So that's the main thing. It's a very fast grower. It's an annual crop. It's used just to build the soil. It doesn't fix nitrogen or anything, but it gives you a cover. It shades the soil. The roots get in there and do the good things that roots do. You just mow it off when it's gotten too big. Try to do it before it goes to seed. So my guess is, in terms of the fast growing part, and something they would almost surely like to eat, buckwheat is a possibility. And it's inexpensive. You're just doing it from seed. Similarly, annual ryegrass can be scattered out pretty much any time, but you probably need to keep them off it until it gets going. So what you would end up doing is what we used to do when I had five dogs in the backyard, cross-fence it, just as if it were a range with cattle. Okay, you cross-fence it. This side is fenced off. You don't go in there while the new grass seedlings or buckwheat or whatever are establishing. Fully established, mowed a couple of times in the case of the grass, or got the density that you're after. That fence comes off, moves over to the other side of the yard. Now the dogs, chickens, whatever, get to go in and do whatever they're going to do. So you have to make sure the plants have a chance to get established. Here's another one, and I'm going to mention this, even though I've many times commented on its what you might call negative attributes. The ground cover called Kurapia, K-U-R-A-P-I-A, which is a hybrid of Lipia, which is botanically Phyla nodiflora. Kurapia is a cross between Phyla nodiflora and another species. Heavily marketed as a lawn substitute, extremely vigorous ground cover, and I mean extremely vigorous ground cover. Please plant this forewarned. A plant will spread as much as 6 feet in one summer, rooting as it does. Blooms all the time. Bees love it. That's good or bad, depending on your viewpoint about bees. Pretty much guarantee it'll grow faster than the chickens will eat it. But you have made a permanent decision when you plant this particular plant. If something that's a little hard to get a hold of, you're buying it from a particular supplier, just go to kurapia.com, K-U-R-A-P-I-A.com. Some nurseries are finally selling it in little starter plants because the patent has worn off on the very first one that came on the market. You can also just buy regular Phyla nodiflora at a lot of nurseries. That's Lipia. It has a lot of really cool common names like Texas Turkey Tangle or all sorts of funny common names. It's a very vigorous ground cover, and I talk people out of it very regularly who think they're going to plant it as a lawn substitute, but for a chicken lawn, could be perfect. Good luck on this project. However, the next page of watering problems, we'll wrap up this topic. It's the other one that I sent you.
Oh, we haven't finished this.
Oh, okay. Go ahead.
Okay, I had two cases of Chinese pistache trees, youngish, about 4 to 5 years old, with older leaves that are yellowing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and that was, and then this cherry tree. So yesterday morning, between 8:30 and noon, we had 5 cases of trees with yellowing leaves, and every one of them was the exact same conversation. 2 of them were the Chinese pistache. 1 was emailed to us. It was in the email when I got there. Older leaves yellowing on a 5 or 6 year old Chinese pistache. Then about 20 minutes after we opened, in walks a lady with a problem with Chinese pistache and wants to show us pictures. And I said, oh, did you email those to us earlier? No. Okay. Another one, 5-year-old, 6-year-old Chinese pistache. Common tree in our area, probably the most commonly planted shade tree in our area at this point. Older leaves yellowing, otherwise looked healthy, but older leaves yellowing. She thought, is this like normal because the days are getting shorter or what? And I said, no. Next one was a red bud. Brown spots on the leaves, leaves cupping slightly, a little burning on the margins, and some of the older leaves yellowing. This was a Western redbud, our native redbud. Next was a pumelo, which, if you know your citrus, is like a giant grapefruit. And overall looked good, good color, some new growth coming. But in this particular case with the citrus, bear in mind they have a thicker, waxier leaf with quite a waxy leaf coating. Some yellowing of older leaves, which we see on citrus very commonly, and sunburn looked, you know, burnt, scorched on the leaves facing due west. And then finally was a cherry tree. And so we're not even to noon yet. Finally was a cherry tree, which just looked horrible. I sent a picture of it to Lois. I don't even know how to describe it, but all the leaves were curled. There was scorch on every exposed part of each leaf. And regrettably, I said, I want him to go home and take some more pictures to show me, you know, where the root flare was and show me the trunk, several points on the trunk that were beginning to ooze. All right. So it's already, this is a tree that he just planted in May. Already got some sapping going on the trunk on the west side of the tree. And
it wasn't painted, was it?
No, correct. It was not painted. It had a lot of foliage. So it had foliage practically to the base. I never did find out whether this was a flowering cherry or a fruiting cherry, but it doesn't actually matter in this case, especially at this point. It had a lot of foliage to the base, which is unusual. A lot of nurseries take all the lower branches up. We wish they wouldn't, but they do. So in this case, there was foliage until it got drought stressed and the leaves started curling and some of them dropped. And suddenly the trunk and interior branches were exposed to direct sun. In each case, at this point, we begin the conversation with, can you tell us how you're watering? How are you watering? And, you know, once we get through the, oh, I'm watering pretty well, or pretty good, I think, or, you know, some real general answer. Okay. What are you watering with? Drip system. Every one of them was a drip system. And how long do you run it? And in no case was it running more than 20 or 30 minutes. I don't know how to distill this down. I rarely run a drip system less than 2 hours. Rarely, especially for a woody plant or a larger perennial or an established plant. I rarely run it for less than that. So a woody plant, when I give it a soaking with a drip system, is getting at least 5 to 10 gallons of water all at once. I may not need to do that again for several days. Could be 2 to 4 days, could be a full week, depending. And as they grow, I extend the water outward, adding more emitters or whatever, and run it longer. So in some cases, I'll be running it for 4, 5, 6 hours. I can't think of any drip system other than for containers that we would run for a few minutes or for even less than an hour. The only case where I can think of running it less than an hour is when you're doing a raised vegetable planter bed and you're doing it every day, which you typically have to do when you first bring in soil, and it's very fast draining soil. You may have to run it. People who have done this have told me typically 35 to 45 minutes every day for a vegetable garden. And that's assuming it's distributing well, that it's got even distribution, that it was installed correctly, and that you have emitters at least every square foot, if not tighter. So I don't know who's coming up with these settings. One that we got the other day was running a system for 4 minutes every single day. 4 minutes. I mean, we talked about
it. Doesn't hardly water. I mean,
you might as well not bother.
Dampen the soil.
We might as well not bother. Yeah. But my question really was, who set it at that? Now, one that we encounter occasionally is every station running every day for 5 minutes. Yeah, that's the factory preset. That's what the timer reverts to. If you had a programmable timer, this was true years ago, and I assume it still is, that your battery died or you forgot to put the 9-volt battery in to conserve the timer if there's a power failure, the preset was 5 minutes per station per day. Not because the company thought that was a good setting. That's just what it reverted to. So it was not uncommon for me back when I did troubleshooting on this kind of thing to go out to a yard, look at the sprinkler timer and find it running 5 minutes every station every day. So, okay, you lost your program. I'll reset it. Now we'll stick a battery in it, replace this battery once a year, every year in the spring. Good idea. But where they're coming up with 20 minutes, 3 times a week, 7 minutes, I don't know. I just don't understand where this is coming from, because there is no rational basis for short duration drip irrigation applications. The closest I've found is when I go to agricultural sites and they're talking about growing melons in Israel or something. And they're calculating exactly how many gallons it needs each day and giving it exactly that for agricultural production, knowing that if they go below that, their yields and quality will be affected. So they're trying to conserve water as a primary goal in an agricultural production situation where your measurable outcome is your harvestable yield. This has nothing to do with home gardens or landscapes, and it's not appropriate at all for any kind of ornamental landscaping. It can work to do 20, 30 minutes if you've hydrated the soil thoroughly. I don't know how many times we've talked about this, but once more, bring your soil to field capacity. In other words, really saturate it thoroughly, which is what I usually tell these people to do, and then wait. Go out with a trowel. You should get to know your soil, get to know your timer, dig around, see how far out that hydration went, see how deep it went, if you possibly can measure that, and then see how long it takes before it begins to dry out. In our area, Davis, Woodland, Winters, Dixon, it's probably going to be 5 to 7 days before it gets to the point where the plant needs water. You don't have to wait that long to irrigate again. You can then begin the process of just replacing the daily ET if you can figure that out. But most people don't have that level of sophistication. So the first thing I'm telling all these folks, go home and just hydrate your soil thoroughly and then wait and see how long it takes to dry out. Because the guy in Woodland with the cherry tree that was not going to recover, it was a brand new yard in a brand new subdivision, very heavy soil, very hard to work that soil. He had big chunks of soil. He had not mulched it or anything when he went to dig the hole. He probably hadn't even watered the area. And he did not, this is really important, he did not hand water after planting. Whenever I plant something on my farm, I hand water it very thoroughly at the time of planting to settle the soil, to make sure I didn't plant too deep. That's another thing he did. Make sure I didn't plant too deep. And then to create a basin that catches water when I do irrigate, so the water soaks in where it's supposed to. And personally, my strong preference is to continue hand watering that tree for the first 2 to 4 weeks as needed. Check daily, water as needed. The drip system is there. It may be already underway in terms of the setting that I'm going to put it at, but I continue the hand watering to make sure I get the distribution that I'm after and to, as I say, settle the soil and create the water zone. I just find also hand watering keeps me on top of it. It keeps me looking at the tree every day, checking the tree daily to see if it needs water. And what's frustrating is when someone walks in with a tree picture or tree itself, it's literally stone cold dead. And they went out there and they found it that way. How often do you go out in your yard? Apparently not very often, because the plant died and they went out, they want to know what went wrong. So check daily, water as needed is one of our aphorisms here. But hand watering can actually make a huge difference. And I know that sounds like a commitment. Well, it's one of the reasons a lot of people don't like to plant during the summer. I do it in the summer because I know I'll do the hand watering that they need. If you want to travel or have a life, maybe wait till fall. But summer is fine to plant as long as you check daily, and water as needed.
And Don is talking about drip systems where it's that little barrel-shaped thing with a tiny little thing coming out the end. That's a drip system.
That's an emitter,
If you happen to have, not that style of thing, but you have a planter where the drip comes off a little, a short extender tube, you can, instead of using a drip, you can use one of those mini sprinklers, which put out a lot more water.
Yeah.
And so depending upon what you're doing, remember the difference between drip and a mini sprinkler. It's important.
I'm going to take a moment to yell at some turkeys. Hold on.
And while he's yelling at the turkeys, I will be admiring the birds. Oh, I hope he keeps this in the show. Oops, he's going to go outside. And okay. So in the meantime, folks, while Don's gone, I want to encourage you to send in comments, bragging, thank yous, all that sort of stuff. Because, you know, it really is nice when we hear from listeners and not only hear the problems, but also hear the good stuff. So, okay.
Okay. They went out the gate. They're very polite about it. Let's see, where were we?
So do you want to explain what you were doing?
I was chasing five turkeys out of my backyard to rejoin the 15 on the other side of the fence.
Do they hop the fence or do they just...
They come in the gate. They're very polite. They came in the gate, so they went back out the gate. They are capable of hopping the fence, but they chose to come in the gate this time. And we get along okay until they start digging up things that I'm planting out there. They don't usually...
And they start harassing your fox.
So the mini sprinklers are great. I usually run them for 4 to 6 hours when I use them. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they really have to run for a long time. So drip really has to run to give a good soaking. And these are the most common problems we're having right now, obviously, are inadequate irrigation. I think a big part of it is that in a normal year, we would have hit this wall of deficit irrigation in late June, early July. And that's when we start to see the samples. And they're pretty obvious then. You have one heat wave, which we really haven't had. You have one heat wave, you get scorched leaves. And so it's really easy to explain to people what's going on. Deficit irrigation, which is just giving plants water that is not quite sufficient to what they need, as the name suggests, manifests itself in different ways with different species. With Chinese pistache, for example, and maples and other deciduous trees like them, the typical pattern is that they'll just start to shed some older leaves. You can imagine what's happening. The roots can't explore dry soil, so they stop growing. The root hairs on that portion of the root system die, but the root itself remains intact, waiting for moisture. And so if they shed 10, 20, 30% of the root hairs, they're unable to take up moisture to sustain all of the leaves and all of the new growth that they're putting on at that time. Some plants, it's the new growth that stops right away. So the plant is growing, crepe myrtles are a good example. They're growing fine, they go dry, they just stop growing. So the impact, since the bloom on crepe myrtles is on the new growth, the impact is reduced bloom. The flower sizes, the inflorescence size is affected, or there's just fewer flowers overall. Things like walnuts, which I have an orchard of, and black walnuts are native ones, they just stop growing. The growing bud terminates. If you water them, they start growing again. They just immediately flush some new growth. Others don't. But one of the symptoms that you commonly see on deciduous trees with inadequate irrigation is older leaves yellowing, obviously not in the fall, but now in the middle of the summer. Well, the plant otherwise looks okay. And in the case of a 4 to 5 year old Chinese pistache, which we had two of within an hour of each other, they're probably just not watering enough of the root zone. I did ask one of them to send me a picture, and they took a picture of this pistache tree, and they had taken out their lawn and gone completely to bark. The entire backyard was barked over, and the tree was planted in the middle of it probably 5 or 6 years ago. The tree looks healthy. It's shading the bark rather nicely. But my guess is, and I asked them to verify this, that the drip system probably just goes in a ring around the tree, one ring around the tree, which was fine for the young tree. And its roots explore when there's soil moisture from the winter rains, a little further past that. And then they're still just watering that ring. So as things dry out, the roots that have tried to expand past the irrigated zone stop, and they can't sustain the leaves that are present. This is an easy one. Just run another ring of drip, and that'll probably take care of it, and run it longer. Sometimes all you have to do is run the existing system longer. Just run it. Try this. You know, this is the simplest diagnostic. Is this a drought stress question? Well, try really thoroughly soaking it, stop, see what happens, see if the plant recovers. That can be a fairly easy way to determine the problem. You may not be watering far enough out. That's one of the most common things we encounter, especially with young trees in like the 5 to 10 year stage, that you're just not watering enough of the root zone. You're probably also not watering deep enough. If it's impractical to run another drip line, and a lot of people kind of flinch when you say, just add, you know, this to your irrigation system. They're not comfortable with their irrigation system. Then you can bypass this. And I do this on my farm all the time for certain trees. Just take a hose, and I like to put a little sprinkler on it, and go out there and give that one tree one time a really thorough soaking with a spot sprinkler, with an oscillating sprinkler, whatever's appropriate to the size of your property. And by which I mean really thorough soaking, saturate the whole zone. Once a month would be fine for most trees that are reasonably low water. Twice a month would be better for higher water trees like maples, for example, along with the existing irrigation system that we hope is at least marginally adequate. So that really deep soaking could be done with your existing system. But one of the reasons I like to bypass that is that even systems that I put in and designed to the nth degree aren't perfect. And I really like some redundancy in irrigation. This is becoming another Davis Garden Show aphorism. Redundant irrigation has advantages. Setting a sprinkler out there every now and then fixes the problems from the poor design of your drip irrigation, because you're just bypassing and watering a different distribution. You ever noticed how with the first rains, everything perks up and looks really good compared to what you've been irrigating all through the summer? Well, all of a sudden, a whole lot of the root zone got hydrated that hadn't been getting hydrated from about 1st of May through the 1st of October. So that's part of what you're seeing, is just the distribution of rainfall. So try that. But again, people just aren't watering long enough. And a big part of this is the way drip irrigation systems are being installed. I don't get it. Just, you know, you may have a landscaper that you like. You may have a maintenance gardener that you like. After they're done and they've set it all up, send me a note. We'll talk about the schedule they've chosen and how likely that is to work for the plants that you have.
Oh, my goodness, Don. I want to jump ahead past our things we have planned for today, and ask you about this plant. I sent you a picture of a citrus plant with yellowing edges on the leaves. We have a new neighbor, and they brought this plant with them. Mm-hmm. It's in a barrel, not quite a half barrel, but in a big tub like that. So what's wrong with this citrus?
This is a Meyer lemon, and Meyer lemons show nutrient, macronutrient, and micronutrient deficiencies more quickly, more readily, more visibly than any other citrus I can think of. I could probably find like 3 different nutrient deficiencies on almost any Meyer lemon tree that I look at. In spite of that, they grow fine, they flower fine, and they yield fine. This one has interveinal chlorosis, yellowing between the veins, progressing in from the outer part of the leaf, which if you look it up, you're almost certain to be told is an iron deficiency. And it could technically be an iron deficiency in the plant, but it's very unlikely that it's an iron deficiency in the soil. Sometimes micronutrient deficiencies like iron, magnesium, which also causes some interveinal yellowing, and some of the others that we see, zinc and manganese, sometimes those are connected to the pH, we are told, the acidity or alkalinity of the soil or water. And so for many years, our whole approach to these in the Davis area, especially where we have water that was predominantly very hard and high in salts back when we were on the wells, we would tell people to apply sulfur. Sulfur brings down the pH. Sulfur is a nutrient that plants use as well, makes them greener, deeper green, and makes typically helps the micronutrients that are deficient mineralize in a form that the plant can take up. So that's part of it. We do find that citrus in containers are more prone to this than citrus in the ground, simply because they don't have enough roots out there exploring soil and taking up nutrients, and they don't have as much mycorrhizal activity. We know that soil mycorrhiza enormously increase the reach of roots. In the ground, the roots can grow out, and the mycorrhiza grow on them and in them, depending on whether they're endo or ectoparasites and beneficials. And they are themselves taking in not just water, but also nutrients and funneling them into the plant. So the more root zone you have, which you're sure to have more of in the ground than in a container, the less likely you are to see these deficiencies. So putting the tree in the ground is one of the simple answers. Feeding it regularly with something that's designed for citrus. One of the reasons for this is one case where the fertilizer is actually a little bit different from the other ones on the shelf. Most of those fertilizers on the shelf that are a particular brand are very, very similar. Citrus tends to be higher in sulfur for this reason. And if it's a conventional citrus food, they add the trace elements so that that'll correct the problem as well, just directly giving it more iron and more manganese and whatever. That can be helpful. Making sure that your citrus food is gentle, maybe a 3:1:2 ratio of nitrogen to phosphorus and potassium. Keep the phosphorus pretty low because phosphates can inhibit the uptake of micronutrients. So high phosphorus is not good in this case. And the key thing would be getting it in the ground. I think that'll make their lives a lot easier. You can grow citrus in containers. Most people who I know who have good, healthy looking Meyer lemons in containers are feeding them every month with some kind of soluble plant food. Whatever it is, that doesn't really make that much difference. They're just feeding them regularly to keep them growing, keep them deep green. They'll have that intervenal yellowing, but you don't notice it as much because the plant has greater vigor and just looks better overall.
All of that by looking at one little leaf. That's amazing, Don.
A lady walked in with four blades of grass. I didn't send you this one. Four blades of grass plucked out 3 inches long and wanted us to tell her what variety it was so she could match her lawn. Not what kind it was, what variety it was.
Oh, my.
We can do a lot from one leaf, but we're not miracle workers. I could tell her, it went like this. What is it? This is a fescue. It's a fine fescue. Oh, which kind? Ma'am, let me explain something. At least a couple hundred new cultivars of grass seed are introduced to the market every year, if not more. And they run through turf trials in 5 or 6 important turf trial areas around the country. And I follow those. I read those charts and I go online. I look at all the results. I could tell you one of 150 possible cultivars that is, and it wouldn't do you any good. I cannot tell you
what's
right.
Compatible.
Right. She wanted to match. She wanted to match. And I said, what you can get is something that'll match good enough. Exactly. No, sorry. You'd have to do a genetic sequencing to figure out which cultivar it is.
You would have had to buy extra seed when you planted the lawn. And then, I don't know, can you freeze grass seed?
It keeps okay, but not that well.
Anyway. Okay, so I have one more walk-in comment that I want you to talk about. This one, somebody walked in and said they were spraying the leaves with copper spray because they looked bad. Yeah. Don, can you clarify what copper spray does?
Yeah, it's a preventative.
Looking bad, not...
No, copper is a preventative for fungus and sometimes used for bacterial diseases like fire blight. More commonly for fungus, it's a preventative. So as a metal, you are coating the leaf with a metal that is toxic to a spore that might land on that surface. And so the spore of, let's say, mildew lands on the leaf that you've sprayed and there's copper on there and it's killed by it because it's at a dosage that is toxic to that. That's really all it does. It doesn't make a leaf look good. It prevents diseases. So this is just part of the. I mean, I see this on online discussions all the time, social media. People post pictures in hobby fruit growers groups of a problem, and the first 5 people will jump in and tell them to spray. I could do a whole checklist of the things everybody's spraying all the time, most of which have no relevance to the picture that was posted. Don't spray things unless you know exactly what you're spraying for, whether the timing is going to make any difference, whether the product you're looking at is going to make any difference. To do that, to figure that out, you're going to need to read the label. And so what I suggest is that every pesticide purchase should be a 2-step process. You identify the pest first. Absolutely the most important thing. People are recommending sprays before the pest has been identified in many Facebook groups. I always spray with spinosad. Really? For a fungus? That's interesting. It's not a fungicide. So first of all, identify the pest. Determine what its life cycle is. Learn all about it, because in most cases, these things have a 2 to 4 week life cycle, and they don't do that much damage. Or in some cases, spraying isn't going to do any good anyway. So figure out whether you could spray anything that would do any good. And then, are there any issues with that? Because in our climate, you don't want to spray anything above about 85 degrees. That's a rule of thumb I came up with years ago. It was a training I had when I was a licensed pest control applicator. Anything above about 85 degrees, especially if it's an oil-based spray, is going to burn the leaves or could burn the leaves. As if it's low humidity, if the plant is drought stressed, those are also factors. So once you've gone home after getting the problem identified and looked up its life cycle and concluded, oh, I guess I do need to do something about this, and you've been given a name of a product, pull up the label online. They're all online as PDF documents. Type in the exact name, company, product name, Up it will come. There's a lot of commercial sites on there that'll give you all the information you want. Look at the PDF of the label, look at the signal words, the precautionary statements, and read the manufacturer's safety data sheet. Now that you're comfortable with the product and you know you have the appropriate protective gear and appropriate sprayer for it, you can go back and buy the product. Reading the label in the store is not a good plan. There are little tiny booklets and tiny print, and it's not good for the retailer for you to be pulling that off of there and opening it up and reading it right there. Take a picture of it. Go home, sit down, read about it, read the whole label, then decide whether you really need to do this. And I'll tell you something, most often you don't in our climate. And I'll say that in our climate is really important because, for example, the hobby fruit growers on Facebook, there are people on there who will say, you can't grow fruit trees without spraying them all the time. And I'll look at where they're from. Oh, yeah, east of the Mississippi, you're probably right. Because if you're back there, you've got fungus diseases, you've got bacterial diseases, you've got insects that'll do a lot of damage. You've got plum curculio, which will get into the fruit and destroy it. We don't have those here. So there's going to be regional differences as to what's necessary. It's really easy to grow fruit trees here. It's really easy to grow roses here without ever spraying them. I know lots of people who never spray either of those things and get wonderful results, partly by choosing the varieties carefully, partly by just knowing the life cycle of the organism and knowing that the plant will typically outgrow it without harm. So don't jump in and spray and never spray without knowing what you're spraying for, why, or whether it's an appropriate time to do that.
Don sent on an email he had gotten from Dave up in Woodland, who said that their plant was struggling.
Yep.
And they have a cherry tree problem. So here are the pictures of the cherry tree. It's a small tree. It's not, I mean, it's not a giant tree. Yeah. It's maybe head high at the most. And all of the leaves on the entire thing are curled. And I mean, it, the length of the leaf is there, and then the sides are curled in. Is that called cupping, Don?
Yeah, and they look, you know, he immediately thought he was overwatering it because that's a very common reaction you'll get when you go online, why are my leaves curling? But this was one where it was a distribution problem of the water. He was watering a lot right at the crown and not out further, and he didn't know how his drip system worked. He never hand watered it to settle the soil. But there's another factor in this one. The first question he had was, can I do anything to save this plant? And this is where he's the one that I had go take some more pictures. It's already got sunburn on the trunk and it's only been in the ground for 2 months. Okay, oh. It's got sunburn on the trunk because of the cupping and the thinning of the foliage. Now the sun was hitting the trunk, which was not happening before. So you've got a plant with a 1-inch caliper that's already got sunburn and oozing on 3 or 4 spots up the trunk. I said, if it were mine, I would replace it. And he goes, well, he mentioned the name before he bought it. Do you think they'll replace it? And my answer is, I don't know what their return policy is. Call them. And they did. Yes, they're going to replace it. Absolutely. Even though this is 100% his doing. Yeah, I can guarantee this was not anything wrong with the plant when he purchased it. They're going to go ahead and replace it for the same reason we often do, which is we want you to be successful. We value the long-term relationship more than the one-time sale. So they're going to go ahead and replace it. But there is one other thing about this. And one of the reasons I'm glad you brought up this particular picture, I looked in closer. I don't see the root flare. I don't see even the collar of where that plant would be at the interface of the stem, the trunk, and the soil. So it was obviously buried too deep. And this is a big problem. If you're familiar with Dr. Linda Chalker Scott, one of my favorite garden professors, and her blog, which is on Facebook, and one of the most common things she wants to ask when someone posts question picture about a tree that's struggling, she goes, get in closer. I want to see where it is at the ground. I want to see whether I can see the root flare, whether I can see the collar. And the answer invariably is no, it's been buried too deep, not covered with mulch. That's not our concern. Mulch is, you know, you have issues, but mulch is porous. Mulch has gaps with air. Yeah. We're talking about buried in soil. And sometimes they'll go ahead and they'll start pulling the soil away, find the landscaper, drop it down like a couple inches too deep. Why would that make such a big difference? Well, air exchange right at the surface is really, really important to a young tree. And so trapping that trunk underground and limiting the air exchange is a real problem. So the plant's roots will struggle. The plant will not establish as quickly. It can outgrow it. It may struggle and fail further down the road. The elevation of which you plant it is really important. So everything, if we tell people, put it up a little bit. We want it up so that water drains away from the crown. We definitely don't want to see that crown under the soil. The other thing is, in our area and any place where it's hot and you're watering, you're inviting Phytophthora cinnamomai, the crown rot, root rot pathogen that we are so concerned about here, because you've got dirt, fine textured soil, trapping moisture right around the bark, not a part that wouldn't normally be underground. And that's an avenue for infection. So we either have poor establishment of the young root system or just plain rot of the roots and the crown because of planting too deep. So that's an important thing to look at. If you're out troubleshooting a tree or you're a landscaper, let's say you're a designer, you're supervising a project and you're a little dubious about the crew, watch them plant a few things, walk out and look at the grade and where they are with respect to the grade. Everything should be up somewhat. Water should always drain away from the crown of a plant. You want water to soak in, so you make a basin. Seems counterintuitive to what I just said. You want water to stay near the tree and soak in, but you don't want it standing around the crown. You don't want the crown buried.
Would it help in general, in our hot climate, when you put in a new tree, would it help to whitewash the part below the leaves so that it doesn't sunburn?
Yeah, that's done. Well, it isn't necessary for a lot of things. If it's a lighter colored bark, for example, a maple or an ash or whatever, it'll reflect the sun, so it won't be a problem. But if it's a cherry, absolutely. You notice all the fruit trees that go in orchards are either protected with a trunk guard, is what they do nowadays, or they would just whitewash them all the way up to the first branch with an interior white latex. Usually you can thin that 50-50 with water. It goes on very easily. Most people just use an old sock or a rag or something to wipe it up the trunk to the first branch. I've had customers paint the whole tree. Okay, fine. Interior water-based latex, fine. Don't use enamel paint for this purpose. And that will reflect the sun. And if it's whitewash that you've thinned out, that'll stay on there for a year or two and then gradually flake off, by which time, hopefully, the foliage will be shading the trunk. The other trees that really need that are avocados. If you happen to be planting avocados, they are very vulnerable to sunburn. But cherries, any of the stone fruits, there's nothing wrong with doing it to other trees. So you very commonly see it done to orchards when they're installed, unless they use the trunk guards.
All right. We have an email from John in Fair Oaks. I have been battling scale on my Akuba for 3 years, and I'm about to give up. I love this plant as it brightens up a full shade corner, but it's becoming a maintenance hassle. Applying neem oil when the summer heat allows does help, as does scrubbing each leaf with a toothbrush. Scale always comes back and forth after a month or so.
Yeah.
Is there anything else I can try to get rid of scale permanently? Or if I yank out the plant and replace it a few months later, will the scale come back on the new Akuba? I love your show and learn something every week. Thank you for any advice you can give me to help this otherwise lovely plant. And he sends a picture.
Yeah, Akuba is a gold dust plant is the name most people know it by. It's got solid green leaf, or in the case of gold dust, golden spots on the leaves. There's also a gold blotched version. The reason these are popular is they're very tolerant of shade, and the variegated foliage is very colorful in the shade, so it's very attractive. They have a flower that's not particularly showy. They have a fruit that's actually kind of attractive, and they're just as tough as can be. But this is a plant that was brought into California 100 years ago. Japanese nurserymen brought it in the 1930s. It was one of the japonicas. Akuba japonica, Fatsia japonica, Euonymus japonica, Ligustrum japonica. That tells you it was from Japan. And at some point, unfortunately, the scale presumably got imported as well. And this scale is very problematic because, as John has found and almost anybody else has found, it's really well attached on there. There are types of scale insects. They don't look like an insect. Sometimes I have to persuade people that they actually have an insect problem. They don't look like an insect. They look like a disease or something. They're little bumps on the leaf, bumps on the stem. It's an insect. It's in the aphid group. Aphids, white flies, mealybugs, scale are all closely related. Scale in its adult stage is waxed over and can't move. It's stuck on there, but pesticides don't kill it because of the waxy coating. At some point, the babies come out from it. They're called the crawler stage, and that is how it moves short distances. It can crawl a few inches, a foot or two on a plant in the crawler stage before it becomes waxed over, sticks onto wherever it is, and can't move anymore. The more common way they move is by ants. Ants will pick up the crawler stage and carry them further out on the same plant, or down your drip line, it's one of the most common things we see, to the plant nearby. And scale can be very host specific. That is to say, only going on Okuba, or only going on Okuba and certain other plants and not on other nearby plants, but the ants will move them there. So the most common way you get it in your yard is on the plant you purchased, sad to say, it's a big problem in the nursery industry, and then by ants moving it from plant to plant. So I can't say that if you did get rid of it, the plant completely, and raked out every bit of it and took it away and went and bought a new Okuba and inspected it meticulously, undersides of the leaves, stem all the way down to the ground, for any scale on the plant you purchased, pretty good chance you won't have scale unless you have another Okuba nearby and a drip system and ants carrying the scale down the drip system. I mentioned the drip system because that's just something I've seen happen. They can also go across the ground or around your foundation or other places, but ants are your problem. And so if you already have a pest control service coming out and dealing with ants around your house, they may be able to help with that. They might be able to steer you towards the bait stations that work for ants, the borax type, borax solution bait stations, which work very well. You can buy them yourself and read about them and how to use them. They're very low toxicity. If you don't control the ants, you won't control the scale. So that's probably the starting point of that part of the conversation. Getting it off of an existing plant is practically impossible because, as you've done, you've scrubbed it off, you've washed it off, you've done all of that. Even systemic insecticides, if they were still available, don't really work on it. So it's the kind of thing where sometimes people bite the bullet, take out the plant completely, rake everything out of there, put in a new plant, either a new version of the same thing or something that isn't susceptible to the scale. Maybe an abutilon would be a good choice there. It's a popular plant for the shade. So it gets its own scale, but a different scale. Scale are very frustrating.
I have never had some problems with my abutilon.
Yeah, it happens, but it's not, they get the brown scale, which is actually pretty easy. This is what he has on here is one that's harder to get off. The scale that you get on your stone fruits, the Lycanium scale, the scale that you get on abutilon, the round or brown scale, those are actually pretty easy to dislodge with a strong blast of water. It doesn't even have to be a pressure washer, although those work like a charm. It can be something like just a good blast with a hose. They're not attached that well. You can watch them being blown into oblivion. This one, I can't remember the name of this particular one, but it's a flatter, more closely adhered to the leaf, and it just doesn't come off that readily with the blast of water. You literally have to kind of scrub it off, which seems like a fairly tedious thing to do with an ornamental in the landscape. So I don't have an easy answer for you here, but if it were mine and I were battling scale, I would probably go ahead and take out the plant. I would clean everything out of there. I'd consider buying a new plant, and I would inspect it very carefully at the time of planting, and I would monitor for ants.
Okay, Holly writes, just a quick follow-up on my previous email that was from February of 2024. I planted store-bought organic red potatoes in a bed because I couldn't find seed potatoes at that time of the year.
Yeah.
I know it's a common problem for California gardeners.
Yeah.
Those potatoes ended up having brown leaf spot, which I have never had before in my garden. And now I'm wondering if they could have brought additional diseases as well, such as some form of wilt or something. Does she need to worry?
Yes, that's one of the reasons we recommend buying certified seed potatoes that are certified to be disease-free. Ones you buy in the grocery store are not. Now, whether you've caused a major problem, I don't know. I don't think so. But the potatoes are rather famous for having caused a mass migration of people from Europe and Scandinavia, in particular Ireland and Scandinavia, to North America because of Phytophthora infestans, which rotted all the potatoes in storage and is a major, major problem with potatoes still to this day. The potato blight of the 19th century, the potato famine, was a result of clonal propagation of the same plant over and over again. A disease got in somehow, spread very rapidly, and the entire stored crop was destroyed. You may have brought it into the garden in that particular case, and so I would be concerned about planting potatoes, possibly tomatoes, maybe eggplant and peppers in that spot for one growing season. I don't know exactly what the brown leaf spot was that you had, so I can't be absolutely sure that this is a concern, but this is one of the reasons for a rotation. And the most common garden rotation that we recommend is for nightshade family members not to be planted in the same spot for 2 years after you've done it, so on a three-year rotation cycle. I always say that, aware that most people don't have a backyard big enough to put everything on a 3-year rotation cycle. So 2 years would be better than nothing. But the key is that we tend to forget that all those favorite summer vegetables, or in the case of potatoes, late winter planted vegetables, are in the same family and susceptible to the same diseases. So you don't want to have potatoes, tomatoes, eggplant, tomatillos, peppers, ground cherry in the same bed they were in previously, or any of them were in previously, for 3 years if you can. 2 years is better than nothing. In the case of tomatoes, we look for disease-free or disease-resistant varieties. That's what the VFN on the label refers to. And there's other disease resistance built into tomatoes nowadays. In the case of potatoes, you just start out with disease-free stock to the best of your ability. And this is one of the reasons that you should look for certified seed potatoes, particularly now that you've had this problem, in the future. I agree. It's difficult to get them in February. My suppliers usually won't send them until March. It's recommended to plant them in February. And I tell my growers who are in Eastern Washington, Idaho, Indiana, these are the places I've typically gotten them from, I'd really like you to ship them in February. And they say, it's too cold up here for us to ship them in February. If you're willing to take the risk, we'll go ahead and do it. But there's 1 year we got them and they'd been, you know, hung up somewhere during a blizzard, and a third of the potatoes were damaged by the cold and we had to throw them out. And that was at our risk because we were the ones that said, we're in California, we want them in February. And we all understood the risk going into it. Usually I get them in March. March is okay. February would be better, but it's hard to find them. Green Acres Nursery in Sacramento sometimes has had them in February. One of my customers gets them there periodically. They're getting them from a bulb supplier who has kept them in storage and ships them out early. So if you're looking around, don't hesitate to go to one of the 4 or 5 Green Acres locations and look for them. Otherwise, just get them in as early as you can. But this is why it's important to use certified disease-free seed potato stock if you can.
Do you know that there is a 27 plus foot tall sunflower?
Indeed.
Tallest sunflower in the U.S.? Wow, this one incredible 27 feet. Can you imagine that?
Yeah, when I was a kid, I grew a 14 foot tall sunflower. We had a flat roof garage. And so there's a picture of me, probably 10, 11 years old, standing up on the garage roof, holding the tape measure that's dropping down to the ground, proving that it was a 14 foot tall sunflower. And I thought that was really impressive. And the flower head was almost 2 feet across. I thought that was really impressive. 14 feet. These guys doubled that.
I got to see that picture, Don. You've never shown me that picture. Do you still have it?
Oh, yes. That's a picture of me as a kid with my 14-foot sunflower. I'll get it for you. That was the year my father was notorious for this kind of thing. Guy came up our street with a dump truck full of manure. So we spread it around as best we could. The rest of it was still there for like 5 years. That's a lot of manure to deal with. And so that was a very heavily enriched sunflower. And I can tell you that it's very responsive to manure. If you ever want to grow a world champion sunflower, start with a dump truck full of manure.
And neighbors that would never talk to you again. So I want to end, as I frequently do, with a garden quote. And I sort of culled a few from Don. He doesn't know this. But no, this is calm, sedate, quiet. No humor in this one. And it is, if you like it, you can probably grow it. And if you can't grow it, well, it's worth learning why not.
Cool. You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
Hello, it's Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.